Interview is with Dr. Henry O. Mears, the present associate principal of Urbana Senior High School in Urbana. We also like to state that after this interview, Dr. Mears was named principal of the Urbana Junior High School, taking the place of Dr. Charles Young. Dr. Mears has been in this community since September 9, 1965. This interview is being conducted on July 13, 1983, in his office at Urbana Senior High School, 1002 South Race, Urbana. The interviewers are Patrick Tyler and Melinda Roundtree, representing the Urbana Free Library Archives Department. This tape is also part one of a two-part series.
Born into a family, I don't know if you want that information. Born into a family of six kids. Father who was an unskilled laborer. And mother who was a household cook. I mean, you know, his business, whose employment was cooking for him, white family.
First, we'd like to ask you about your childhood experience. You know, how was life growing up in North Carolina?
Life as a kid, I had a unique experience. I think it was pleasant, while at the same time there was some unpleasantness. Keep in mind that in the early 40s, okay, and also 50s until I left the community to go on into school, is that the North Carolina at that time was a segregated, I mean, it was, today they call it racism, but it was a segregated community. I mean, blacks on one side of tracks, whites on the other side of tracks. Blacks went to one kind of school, whites went to another kind of school. Blacks went into the back door, while whites went into the front door. I mean, this was the whole Jim Crow type, and the whole race, black-white relationship in the South. Those were a lot of unpleasantries for me, simply because blacks, at that time, and particularly myself, was denied many things that I thought I was capable of doing. Having to leave the streets a lot, having not been permitted to be downtown after 6 o'clock because I was black, and simply another reason being is that the my town was heavy inundated with Ku Klux Klansmen. I mean, this was the headquarters for the Ku Klux Klans in that county, which also made it difficult. Of course, there's a lot of things I learned from that community because I was forced to, given the economic situation and given the employment situation and given the status that blacks had at that time, I was forced to seek other ways in terms of survivor type skills. And I learned a lot as an individual kid how to survive in that kind of environment, how to articulate my needs and how to make sure that my needs are facilitated without having to violate what I saw as a social trend, a social policy, or even a social mandate in that community. It was difficult. I can mention that one of the most unpleasant things that I've ever experienced, having experienced all this segregation, having experienced the treatment by whites in terms of you know, this whole black servitude or slavery that was still in existence, and to some extent still is in existence, is that I attended an elementary school in a three-room school. Okay. There was grades K through first grade. There was no such thing as K because we didn't go to school in kindergarten. okay? It was first grade through eighth grade, and that it was a three-room school, and all grades were located within those three rooms. After leaving elementary school, I went on to high school, which is 12 miles away to my town, one way. It was a round trip of 24 miles. I experienced some real unpleasantries in that school because what I experienced, I was very accustomed to racial segregation. I was very accustomed to that. But what I wasn't accustomed to was class segregation. Okay, so when I attended this high school, I found out that the city boys had more opportunities available to them than the little country boy like me who left 12 miles to go to the school. It was almost like we were of a different class. Okay, and we did not fit, therefore, and we were not worthy, and we did not have anything valuable to offer. And this was an all-black setting. To validate that, I was told by a black high school principal who was in charge of the Westside High School where I graduated at age 15th in 10th grade. I elected to take an algebra class. My first experience with algebra, of course, I didn't know anything about algebra. Okay? I mean, mathematics just kind of fascinated me. And I was in a class where, at that time, they had teaching principles. You know, you taught one class, and his major was math. He taught math. I was in a class of all blacks, remind you, the entire school was black. There were, and I can't recall if there were 15 members of that class, and of course there's one or two girls, but most were boys. He distributed at the first class meeting the algebra book. And I was the only student in that class that came from my hometown or came in on the bus. Okay, from out of the city. He distributed every member of the class a textbook for me. And I told him he had forgotten me. I reminded him that I didn't get a book. And he reminded me he had no intentions of giving me a book because this class, that particular class, as he explained to me, was for students who were going to make something of themselves. Kids who was going on to college. And his perception of me having my background coming from where I came from meant that I had no intentions, neither did I have anything to offer anybody in terms of going on to college. I was hurt. I mean, I was very hurt. I was hurt, okay? Now, that was both a deterrent for me at the same time, it wound up being motivation for me. I quit school. I was gone away from school for 3 weeks until I decided to some other kinds of hard experiences I had outside of school that I did not want to be to live with the rest of my life. Neither was I going to try to survive, you know, make a livelihood for myself when I thought I had more other things to offer. So anyway, I quit school, but I did come back. I didn't take algebra because I wound up really hating this guy. But I did wind up finishing high school. I did go into college. I did go on to get a master's degree. I did go on to get a PhD degree. Okay. And I did wind up taking, I was forced to deal with algebra when I was doing my PhD program. Okay, because I had to take research and statistics. Okay, and I wasn't given a background for that those types of statistics because you really have to have a strong algebra background. Okay. But I managed to get through it with an A. And that's kind of complimentary to me, having getting an A in statistics at the University of Illinois, where a significant high percentage of graduate students flunk. So it was, to me, it was, somehow it operated in the reverse. It did turn around and it motivated me because I was determined to prove that point. I guess that's one of the most unpleasant. You know, having thinking that your worst enemy was a white man, when it turns out, really, in your life, it's a black man. which I had a lot of confidence in. I never did think I'd ever experience that. But I did. Okay.
But, well, can you tell us a little bit about your family, background, brothers and sisters?
Well, yes, I was, came up in a family, and I don't wish to sound like, at this point, Cinderella or even a country pumpkin, but I came up in a family that was, by any stretch of the imagination, was destitute. Very poor family. But we were the kind of family who always operated independently, and we depend and we teamed with each other, okay, to survive all of the challenges that we had, economical challenges that we had. Unfortunately, I was the first member of the family to go and get a college degree of the entire Mears generation, Black Mears, the most immediate Black Mears generation, to go on and get a college degree. The unfortunate thing is that I was probably one of the less brighter ones of the family. And I say that because I had some very bright brothers. One sister who did wind up getting nursing training. And I'm one of four boys. One brother of mine, who is the next oldest, wound up going into service, quit high school and went to service because he was not about the experience, and he did experience the same thing I experienced at that same high school. Okay. We knew where we stood, and where we stood in the eyes of those people who were in that school was that nowhere. We had nothing to offer. Therefore, nobody spent the time doing it, working with us. Then I had another brother, and I don't know if that was a rational an excuse for him, who quit school in ninth grade, who went on to, he's working now for an airline, and he was working in a skilled position and very successful. I have a younger brother, which we all sort of pooled our resources to at least tried to guarantee certain kinds of opportunity for him, that who's now in law school at the University of North Carolina, and I think this is his last year in law school. My parents right now are both are living, and relatively young parents. My father is only 62 years old. My mother is 63, something in that area. So they're relatively young parents, but now I'm 42. So it's a rather, and I have a sister who's 44. So my parents are very relatively young. What else can I say? I mean, we had one thing that we valued, and that was the faith and the confidence and trust and the love we had for each other. We valued that. We thoroughly valued it. We depended upon that. And we depended upon and we lived by the rule that no one is going to do a heck of a lot for you. Okay? That what if you really going to be a successful individual at anything, regardless of what it is, okay? Do your best at it. Operate with your best potential. Put your best foot forward. And you got to do it with yourself, and you got to be. It's ironic that I talk about this thing because I'm also right now going through some changes with some black situation that I experienced even in my childhood, but I won't deal with that. But it is. It's quite a remarkable family. It still is quite a remarkable family. We had a lot of self-pride. Very independent. And we always believe that nothing is worth doing unless you want to sacrifice and put forth your own energy to do it. And that's when it becomes most valuable to you. That's when your pride is most It's not when you have had it given to you. Neither is when you have had to walk over the backs of others to achieve it. You have to deal with it honestly.
Okay. What college did you graduate from?
I went on to Fayetteville State College, which is now Fayetteville State University. That was an all-teacher training college when I entered in 1959. I got my bachelor's degree from that school in elementary education in 1963. Again, it was that was another thing I was very proud of in myself. And I think, not boastfully, but I think I have a lot to be proud of. I worked my entire way through school because I had no monetary resources, outside resources. No.
How about your master's? Where did you receive it?
I completed a master's at the University of Illinois. Got my master's, it was in 1968. After coming to Atlanta, having taught in Atlanta for a couple of 3 years, and the university was available, I had to go to the university. Did my master's degree part-time work. Got my master's in 68. I later went on back to school and I took a course here and a course there in a non-degree program. I wasn't interested in going to a degree. And then later I did decide that I would pursue a doctorate degree, which I did that part-time basis. And that was completed in 1982, last year.
What motivated you to come to the Champaign area?
Interesting you would raise that question. After graduating from college, I guess I had, some people would call it at that time, high ideals, okay? For the simple reason, I thought I had a lot to offer, okay? That even those in my rural area, North Carolina, could not begin to appreciate, okay? And what I really wanted to do is to make sure that I had a broad experience and feel things out for myself, and not only to test what I thought I had to offer, but at the same time, to see if that's the direction I want to go. Well, I wound up going to Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, which I worked for 2 years, and nothing had to do with teaching the school. From one thing to another, I was involved in, as a truck driver, semi-truck driver, and I got a chance to travel, et cetera. The other thing, I was involved in a civil service job with the state unemployment office, and I finally came to Champaign-Urbana. I learned about Champaign-Urbana through a friend of mine who was in graduate school at the University of Illinois, okay, and who came back to visit me and who continuously tried to influence me to go back to graduate school, which at that point I was not interested in, because I didn't see myself going to classroom and being a graduate teacher the rest of my life, at least until I felt comfortable with that's what I want to commit myself to. I'm kind of a stubborn person, I need to make up my mind, and once I commit myself to something, I'm committed to it. I did come out and visit. I had an opportunity to talk at that time with the principal of King's School, who was I was introduced to by this friend of mine who was in graduate school and who's now a professor at the University of Illinois. And I talked with Dr. Buston, who was principal of King's School, and we had a long conversation about education directions and this trade and exchange in viewpoints. Okay. As it turned out, he was informally interviewing me. He later introduced me to, at that time, his director of personnel, Mr. King. And to make a long story short, after going through several formal interview sessions, because Dr. Buston apparently saw something in me that he wanted, as part of the staff, I was out for the job, the teacher for the school. And somehow, some way, I wound up saying yes later and accepted the job at King School. And I taught there for 3 years, and I left King School and went into junior high school as assistant principal. And from the junior high school, of course, where I spent the first 10 years of my administrative, the first 9 or 10 years of my administrative experience, came into the high school and personally worked there.
What year was it when you first came, Sam?
Oh, in 1965. September 9, 1965.
How was things, well, people in the black community when you first came?
Well, it was, not as visible, you know, in 1965 as the black community is now. And maybe so because the people, as I saw, was not as actively involved in what goes on around them. They did later become involved simply because of the social trends and the movements that happened across the country. That was in the late 60s, and, you know, 68, 69, when things were hot, okay? People did become involved, and I think that generated a lot of the concerns and involvement of Puerto blacks. Initially, when I first came to the city, it was very strange because most of the interaction that occurred in the black community occurred with the black community had their ties with Chinook, Rantou, okay? So anybody who was new face in the community, the perception of the black community was that you were an airman. You came through Chinook, okay? There was little opportunities, at least from my standpoint, that had been available to blacks in some of the professional type jobs. Such as teaching school, and you know, that's been the perception that we talk profession, you say, it's always been the syndrome of blacks. When you talk professional, they either look at you as, the first thing that comes to mind is you're either a school teacher, okay, you're a barber, okay, you're a beautician, or you're a minister. That used to be the categories of what they call black professionals and black business people, okay, or you cook barbecue, whatever. But that was the perception of the black community. The black community was not actively involved. There was a few people who were actively involved in some of the city politics. But it was relatively quiet, I should say. And it's not to say they didn't have concerns, but the mechanism had not been developed by which those concerns were being articulated, other than through one or two sources available to them through the city council, in particular in Champaign. And to some extent, yeah, it wasn't about. It was, you know, it's hard to describe.
How about doing, you know, the, like you was talking about, when the things that got kind of hot during the civil rights movement? Mm-hmm.
Well, during the civil rights movement in the Twin City, there was more active black involvement, okay? And that involvement on the part of adults was really precipitated simply because, generated by the youth community, because the youth began to formulate their own gangs. Okay? And then they were more actively involved. Unfortunately, you know, they were almost at rivalry with each other, not actively involved in a civil rights movement as a collective group, fighting in behalf of the civil rights movement. For the most part, they reinforced the perception that whites have always held, that we always fight among ourselves and damaging ourselves as opposed to fighting for the cause. But that was generated, and then later it was redirected by some of the key concerned members of the black community and redirected into a more constructive path.
Talk about the job as a teacher at King School.
Mm-hmm.
How was it? What grade did you teach?
My first assignment was at King School. I think I was employed as a sixth grade teacher. At that time, we had operated in groups and teams, okay? The intermediate, the primary, the primary, the middle primary, and intermediate, the upper primary, and the intermediate, okay? And I was part of the intermediate team, which taught across grade 4, 5, and 6. My major responsibility was the language arts for the 6. I was kind of the home teacher for 6th grade. The language arts, social studies, and in the team approach, I taught PE and science to 4th, 5th, and 6th grade students, and that was my major teaching responsibility. I enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I can't, because I've had some pleasant experiences in both junior high and high school, but I guess it's the context in which I put them in. It's almost, I can't, the experience at King School still stands out as one of the most memorable experiences that I maybe because I first went into my teaching profession, but it was a very memorable experience. The school was 99.9% black. I remember having classes of all black students, students who had never had heard but never knew what Chicago looked like. And I felt good that I had provided them those kinds of experiences. That, you know, we went to Chicago. We didn't talk about the state, Illinois history, without touching the history of Illinois. We touched the monument at Springfield. We touched the Lincoln Memorial House, and that's the way we had history. And that's where we learned the history of Illinois. By the same token, I had experience, and I refrained from calling names, students who came to me and couldn't read. Never knew what it was like to experience reading. And it was a joy to me to see the joy on their face having me work with them and read it. And having learned certain reading concepts that they had never been taught before. I used to do a lot of Saturday morning tutoring at King School for anybody who's willing to come, and even adults that I worked with that couldn't read. I mean, I'm saying it's the most memorable experience because I feel that I do have a talent. I am fortunate that I do have a particular skill, whether it's by a God gift, where it was by where it was by just the training provided me by an institution, okay? I have that skill, and I feel it would be utterly remiss on my part not to share that and see that as many people benefit from my skill as possible. And that was, I saw it as my professional mission. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it because I enjoyed, and I hate to think what I would have been had I not had this kind of enjoyment, this kind of experience in my profession. I thoroughly am committed to my teaching, profession. It's a joy to me to see, to think that I can leave an institution during the day and think that I have made a difference in somebody's life. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. You think, and you know, and I quote what a gentleman said to me, if I call his name you would know it, who had no formal training in school. He said, "Henry, if politicians and successful people who criticize the schools," and we're talking about today's issue with the merit pay and what the schools are not doing, "who criticize the school will stop and think that they are successful because of experience in their life, and for the most part, it was an experience because of a classroom teacher." He said, "If that's the case, why knock education?" Okay? Okay. It was a negative thing on my part, but I moved in the profession. I was motivated simply because of the experience I had with my black principal. It wasn't a positive experience, but it certainly worked in the reverse. I would love for it to be a positive experience, okay? But unfortunately, it wasn't. Okay. But I think it was on that experience I had. Of course, the experience you get at the secondary level with at the junior high school is a different kind of experience too. And they all, you know, they all are different kinds of experience, and they all have a certain play a significant role in my whole professional experience. And I don't try to prioritize one against the other. They all are significant. Each one of those, King School, junior high school, and the high school. Different and significant.
Please tell us a little bit about the junior high experience.
I entered junior high school in 1968 as an assistant principal. At that time, I was one of the few blacks on the staff. Moreover, I had some difficulties simply because, not just the mere fact of being black on the junior high school staff, who had little experience with black administrators and positions anyway, other than the fact that Taylor Thomas, I think, was black assistant principal here at high school, that it complicated the fact that I was younger. And yet, at the junior high school, I had a wide range of experiences, from the area of discipline to program development, trying to implement programs, and try to come up with all kinds of experiences, suggest and strategize experiences that I know that could yield the best success for students, a group of students. And I saw that it was enjoyable to me, still enjoyable to me, to see that there's something that we all could get together and work on, that somebody had some success. I felt some success in terms of experiencing. High school, I came to high school in 1977. Even was more of a, you know, another kind of challenge. Because I had seen the elementary, I've seen the junior high. Now I see them ready to leave for the last time. And the last chance and the last hope they have for being skillfully equipped to handle this ruthless world. And I too saw a mission in that. To feel that a mission from the standpoint of having the responsibility of playing a critical role to see that those skills are adequately met so that they can adequately deal and effectively deal with the adult life.
What were the difference in the black children that attended the schools? How did they react to, you know, school? And did they interact very well, you know, in time and progress, or were they better when you first started interaction?
Well, I don't think the wishes and the motivation of black students were any more significant now than what they were then. I think the problem then is that while blacks were motivated and had the same kinds of desires, they didn't have nearly the resources in terms of the skills, okay, to pursue those kinds of directions and those kinds of goals. Everybody, and always will be, and I think blacks have always valued education, okay? And the value placed on education then among the black families, among black students, is no different than what it is today, okay? Except that today has been a more of a concerted effort on the part of the black community, a more concerted effort on the part of schools themselves, okay? To see that blacks get the same equal opportunity, okay, to at least maintain or have those skills it take to be successful. and pursue those kinds of goals. I think the values is basically of education is basically the same. The opportunities, I think, as a result of the movement, the concerns raised, the civil rights movement across the country, I think the opportunities for black had been open. Okay. Yet at the same time, blacks are still having a tough time trying to maintain, at least trying to appeal some of the key types of positions. And this is also true in education. In other words, I don't see any real difference in the motivation or desire or the need or the value they perceive and the value they held on education then as opposed to now. I do see that blacks are taking more of an aggressive and concerted effort to develop some strategy by which that is to be occurred. That is by which that is to be developed. The problem is if the schools and the public institutions have been as responsive to those kinds of needs, wishes and strategies as proposed by blacks. I don't see the schools and public institutions in terms of black needs and education any more responsive now than what they were. They were more responsive then than what they are now. Because I think there's a period where there was a certain level of sensitivity for blacks in public institutions. At least there was a guilt that yes, maybe we have done some wrongdoing, and yes, maybe we should open up some opportunities, okay? And at the same time, is that it had been made known by many key leaders in this country that we have to implement and present policies and legislation that will affect the civil rights of blacks, okay? And they mandated some of those things, so now it's a matter of just following mandates. And in some instances, our institution is trying to get rid of the same mandates that were legislated several years ago to guarantee certain opportunities for blacks. Okay, so in other words, I don't see the responsiveness being as great now as it was then. And I think it's even more critical now that schools be responsible to development and strategy for blacks and their skills in terms of being successful and pierce the jobs that I think blacks too have the capability of pursuing.
I was wondering about your involvement in the community, in the black community. Could you tell us some, if you have joined any organizations?
Well, it's kind of strange on how one views involvement. Yes, I've always been involved in the black community. I've always been part of black organizations. Matter of fact, I was involved in the initial first concerned citizen group that existed at the time, which white perceived as a radical group of blacks, okay? When it wasn't popular to be a part of, simply because I was part of the school and spoke with a professional man, and this was a direct conflict. Well, yes, I was always involved in that. I have served on a number of boards. I've always been involved in the church. I am not one who is a visible, active religious person. I'm one who believes in God, okay? Very much believes in God. But I also believe that, and I hold very dearly to the principle that we have to believe in fellowshipping, okay? And fellowshipping to me is not doing it publicly. Fellowshipping to me is doing it inner with myself. And I don't worry about who knows how much fellowship I do. It's not stacking and showing how many, it's not showing your track record, okay? And comparing your track record publicly. Yes, I have been. I have been involved in the black community. Whether one interprets involvement as one who's out there all the time carrying a picket sign and doing like that. Well, I have a kind of a personality that doesn't lend itself often, frequently, to those kinds of activities. Yet at the same time, it does not mean that I can't actively be involved to affect the change by which we all are trying to bring about that affect blacks. Yes, I've served on a number of boards in a number of areas, and I have also initiated some things myself with the black community. And see, Pat, it's not really what I do to gain visible credibility for the black community, okay? It's what I do for Pat when Pat needs it done, okay? See, my way of fellowshipping is this, is Pat, is that I have, to some extent, I don't want you to interpret this as being boastful, okay? I don't want to say that I have arrived, because I'm still the nigga. Anyway you slice it, I don't care where you go, the white American still perceives the nigga, okay? And it's a reality with me, okay? But the point being is that I believe wholeheartedly is that it's the way you have to strategize this, is that I have skills to offer, okay? I have experience that you can benefit, okay? I have some authority that I think I can perfect things for you, okay? So the point is do it for Pat, okay? And what Pat is supposed to do is do it for her. What she's supposed to do is not forget who done it for you. Okay, and that's got to be passed, almost a broad chain reaction that we have to do. Other ethnic groups do it to affect their lives. They do that. They manipulate their resources. They do that, Pat, and that's something we have to, as a black group, we have to do. Now that's my involvement. That's my involvement. And when I involve myself in that kind of thing, I don't expect to get up and say, well, Henry Mills has done this and Henry Mills is doing that and Henry Mills is doing that. Okay? That's not why I do it. Okay? I don't expect to be accountable. To give account of that until Pat, excuse me. So, that's my way of operating, Pat. Pat, I've seen it all. See, one cannot talk to me about racism. One cannot talk to me about classism. One cannot talk to me about being denied opportunities, okay? And one cannot talk to me about having confronted strategy where you know people are setting up strategies, be it black or white. I've experienced it all. See, I've experienced strategies where blacks are just as guilty of what they accuse whites of doing to deny blacks opportunity, okay? Because at that point, they want to bring about, at that point, it becomes not racism, but classism. Okay? So, I have a tough time dealing with that. I think we have to deal with the standpoint of open and honesty in terms of if we're all about that mission, we're all about the mission. Okay? See, we're all about the mission. We don't have to do a check and balance on each other. We have to say what he's doing and what he's not doing. Okay? Because we all have confidence that we're all about the same mission. Okay? And no one worries about, well, how much of that have you done and how much of that I've done. Okay? See, because Pat, as I go back and I think, and I get, and I think, and then one of the things that I do feel good about, I frequently get phone calls and say, Mr. Mills, I want to thank you. Remember so-and-so? Remember that time? Okay? And this is not from black kids. That's my mission. That's my mission. Because Pat, the poor white kid is in worse shape than the black kid. Because he does not, or she does not have the advocate for them that black kids have frequently in our public institutions. See, Pat, you can come to me as an example, as a black kid, because you, for whatever reason, perceive that Mr. Mears might be, you know, amenable or at least sensitive to my problem because I'm black, okay? Well, how many poor white kids can identify somebody in their staff that they can lean on? Not always the case. Not always the case. Okay, but I'm just trying to make a point.
I have a question about, Dr. Young and what's happening. The churches are supporting him a lot, and I was wondering, when you came here, with the church as much involved as it is now, with the things going on in the community, with people trying to help them, give justice to them?
Well, I think the concerns were there. Okay. But see, when I first came into ministry, I don't think the church had really developed the structure by which they articulate that kind of involvement. And I think that's been a big plus in the community. Now they have developed that structure, okay, and that strategy by which they can become involved in terms of to get involved in activities that do affect, okay, blacks in the community. You have to understand that's one of the purposes of the black church, period. It's always been one of the church purposes of the black church. Okay? And this is not to say it's just serving God is secondary. No, that's not the case. Okay? But church has always been that institution by which blacks rallied around, okay, to express his own concerns about what happens and what affects them. Okay? But collectively, that had not happened in this community because they had not developed that kind of strategy and structure. Maybe at that point there had not been a need to do so until the civil rights movement. And if you know, that whole civil rights movement generated out of the church. Okay. See, Martin Luther King was about God. Okay. And Martin Luther King knew that God was about humanity. So I'm saying that whole thing rallied and generated around and about the church.
Another thing is the government, the form of government. When you came here, was it more for people? Did it benefit blacks?
No. No more than what it does right now. Okay? Keep in mind that, and I'm just a believer of this, I don't think the democracy and the government in our country, and it also is the same way local. See, local is no more. See, local government is just a replica of what happens nationally. Okay? That they're no more concerned. Maybe I'll retract that. While there may be some concerns about me, the ultimate concerns is about him. Okay? Him, meaning that it's the government. Okay? We operate in this society, and our society always reflects the government policies, mandates, and the like, and the behaviors of government, okay? We operate with a society that's a class society. And we operate with a philosophy, and we actually practice, even in our schools, our governments, our churches, classes. Class. There's somebody got to be on the bottom. In the black community, there's somebody's got to be on the bottom. Usually it's the guy who doesn't have a degree. Okay? It goes right back to the same thing I talked to you about in my high school days. Somebody in that school system, in that all black high school, had to be on the bottom. And it was those kids who rode the bus. Poor kids, poor black kids. See what I'm saying? That's the syndrome we operate from. In this whole American society. In public institutions, in public schools, somebody's got to be on the bottom. Who is it? Usually black kids. in government, in legislation, okay? Mandates are there to affect the mass majority. Now, who's the mass majority in this community, in this society? White, middle class. Okay? Give an example. Black kids in Harlem, New York, in the 30s, the 40s, bitches, always, blacks always experienced with heroin, drugs. Always. Okay? There's always been sort of one of the activities in New York and many of the cities, okay? I knew blacks when I was coming, it was spirit of marijuana, okay? Because that's how certain white leaders made they capitalize on the weaknesses of blacks, okay? But see, we never recognized there was a drug problem until certain whites started handling drugs. Okay. And it's like a classic statement I've always said. I came in a band in 1965. I used to see kids in Kings Park all the time smoking and experimenting marijuana. Okay. Marijuana and drugs use in Havana schools did not become an issue to a couple of white kids. And I say a couple, but to the white kids on Southeast Havana. Started taking more than 3 aspirins. Okay? Then it became a problem. Okay? Because that, I don't think the government has significantly changed. It's unfortunate that, that in a society that people have to remind people that we are human beings too, even when we make a significant percentage of the society as blacks. I don't think it's changed that much. I think it's changed in terms of how blacks have been able, by way of skill and by way of training, to infiltrate certain professions and certain positions. But I don't think the attitude has changed. And I think Reagan has proven that. Okay? I think the attitude is still there. Because you know what Reagan represents, right? But you also know the big population they put in there. Isn't that the thinking of this community? Isn't that the thinking of the country? See, the president of this country, by way of election, the personality, the behavior of the president, always reflect the population of people who elected him. So when you talk about Reagan, you're not talking about a personality. An individual man, what you're talking about is a significant population in this country. He represents the thinking of the majority of this country. Keep that in mind. You know, so you're not criticizing him as an individual. See, when he talks about supporting schools who segregate against blacks, private schools. I mean, giving them tax breaks. You know the issue. I don't know if you know the issue. Well, there are several schools in this country, and one is in North Carolina, Jones University, okay, who are getting tax breaks as a non-profit organization. That's a big chunk of money, okay? That means it's government supported. Tax breaks, when they won't, they segregate are discriminated against blacks. Blacks can't enroll. Private schools. And what Reagan is saying is that they have a right to do that. Now, certainly that is the thinking of this country. Okay? Well, Reagan said he agrees with that. Now, he didn't, that man didn't say he'd agree with that if he didn't have to back him with a lot of people. Keep that in mind. So, I'm saying, and I'm not sitting here trying to be overly critical about government, but I'm saying there's a reality that does not limit itself to just race. Also, it's a class reality. If you were in a town of all blacks, honey, I would stake my life on it. You would have the same discrimination that you experience in a mixed population. But there, we call it class. A mixed population, we call it racism. And it's both in a mixed population, racism and class. Now see, in a mixed population, even when you're white and poor, you don't have anything going for you. Okay? But what you have going for is when you're poor white, who's operating competitively with the black. But if you're poor white, operating with another white, you don't have anything going for you. But you have something going for you when you operate against black. Okay?
About the job opportunities, how would they make
the first? Well, let me try to sum that up this way, is that there were not many job opportunities for blacks because there are certain positions that white, the local white community perceived that blacks should hold and shouldn't go any further, okay? And that still holds true. I'm not saying that's changed very much. You haven't seen a black superintendent? Okay. That has not changed very much, okay? Is that because that has certain amount of whites, a certain amount of authority, and which comes along with some expertise that we don't feel blacks have, okay, to perform in those areas. When I first came into the community after the first 2 years, I received a master's. I was working on a master's degree, which I was to receive in August of 1968. The individual who was director of personnel at the time, we got in a casual conversation. I'll never forget it. It was a hall of King School. And he said, you're working on your master's. I understand you're just about finished. I said, yeah. He said, what do you intend to do? I said, well, I'm working on my master's. No. I said, I'm working, getting my master's in elementary education. I'm putting some emphasis on school administration. Okay. He said, well, there's not very much around here in administration. But see, he's the same guy who's director of personnel and the same guy who knew right away that there were two jobs available in director as one job, I believe, in principalship as an administrative job open in Urbana. But what he was telling me, there's not much for blacks. That's exactly what he was telling me. And I tried to make him tell me that. And he wouldn't admit it. I said, what you're telling me is not anything for blacks. Okay? By the same token, is that, and I have experienced situations where, that I personally challenged for some jobs I wasn't successful in getting. It's hard to say that it was because of race, because at the same time, I had to go back and to look at my credentials. You see what I'm saying? I mean, to make sure that I'm thoroughly qualified, at least competitive. See, one thing you have to keep in mind is that you have to be twice as good, 10 times as good, to compete with the average white for certain positions. You got to be super. See, the average white can come up and land, and I'm not saying that, that's as a put down, okay, but it's a reality that the black guy who beat the average white out on a job is a super black guy. He's super, or she is super, okay? Absolute super. Any running back you ever know that played football was a superstar, wasn't it? You never know ordinary blacks running. You had ordinary whites, didn't you?
Right.
Okay. And you right now today, if you are a football fan, right now today, when you see a black quarterback in the pros, you immediately think that he must be super. Okay? And it's just the reverse in basketball. When you see white guys now in basketball,
you think they must be super, that they can play with it, super black. You see what I'm saying? So, it's the context in which you, in which you, you place that.
I want to talk a little about school, since you've been, King and Brendan, how the parents interact with the student, the students in school, so that they can involve with the teachers and come see teachers talking to them about their work.
Unfortunately, there's never been enough of black parents involved in the schooling of the kids, okay? And I'm one who holds true, holds firm on the belief that if you want your kid to have successes in our public schools, you got to take an interest in what direction they go, okay? You cannot chance leaving the total livelihood and the total education of your child up to a classroom teacher. You got to make sure you're there not to tell a classroom teacher what to do or not to supplant the classroom teacher in terms of one's skills and strategies and providing a professional professional strategy by which to provide your child some experience. But you're there to help remind and help to remind teachers that they too have a responsibility and must be accountable to the teaching and learning of your kid. By the same token, you got to show your child that you're interested in that. There's old saying that charity starts at home and spreads abroad, and I believe in that. Too frequently, and having had experience in the public schools, and we aren't perfect, okay, but too frequently we leave the education of our child up to the public schools. You know, I mean, we don't take a direct interest in it. Now, let's look at that from a political standpoint. I'm talking about a real, that was an idealistic parental kind of involvement, community idealistic kind of involvement once you take the school. But let's look at it from a political standpoint. The average classroom teacher, and I say average now, there are some people who are beyond that point, but the average classroom teacher is going to respond to the child that she knows or he knows that the parent is most concerned with. That's just human nature. It's human nature. It's human nature. Okay? Because this young man on my left is entering in a school where his parent is never involved. You don't see him around, or he comes from an area where, you know, people don't get involved. Okay? And he may be highly motivated. And this may be an extreme case, but I'm just trying to make a point. It's not true all times, okay? As opposed to you, okay, who comes from a family that you know is well known, know is going to watch the teacher every move she makes, okay? Okay, because I'm going to have to be accountable for that. You see, that's dealing with the human nature. And that's why I say, and I hate to say, use the term, that there's certain kinds of threats and intimidations that just the mere presence of people in terms of, but maybe that's what public schools need. Maybe that's what we need. I welcome parents in. Oh, I love to see parents, whether we agree or disagree, I love to see parents actively involved. I love to see that. As a matter of fact, I used to pull all kinds of stunts when I was teaching at King School because I never saw a parent in King School, and King School is right in the heart of the community. Okay? But I find myself having to do social work, which unfortunately, I had to go around the next block and visit. Okay? And I had to do certain things and write certain notes that aroused parents and made them mad so they didn't come out and argue with me. You follow what I'm saying? And it was almost like a given. But that's the kind of thing that you get involved in. Pat, is that I welcome that. I think that's what makes a healthy learning environment. See, we've always treated learning and schooling as if though it's something that only the
the privilege should have. Okay? And that's the way we operate it, because it's only the privileged who've been out there just bidding for their share. Okay? The underprivileged has never been actively bidding for their share. So therefore, we don't feel as nearly responsive to them. Okay. I applied for a job once, Pat, and I won't tell you where. Well, I was not offered a job, okay? When everybody knew on the entire committee that it was obvious that I was head and shoulder above the person who finally got the job, okay? But the reason given to me, when I asked why wasn't I off the job, is that I was too committed to the black and the poor kid. That's how I was perceived. That's unfortunate. But it's also complimentary to me, because he told me who I am. Okay. See, Pat, my argument is that if you come to me as a person who does not have reading skills, okay, and she comes to me gifted, as described and defined by all our criteria, okay, as a gifted child who's a superb reader. See, I feel more responsive if I got a choice between the greatest, most motivated, most outstanding teacher. I think you would benefit most from that teacher than she would. That's my feeling. You need it most. See, she can still survive the lazy, incompetent, non-concerned teacher. You can. That even further complicates your problem. Okay? See, that even further complicates your problem. Okay. And that's, you know, I mean, of course, you can't always stack that up, because that's not the way we operate this system. But honestly, in many cases, if you walk in some of the school systems, and you look at where your programs are, your gifted programs.
Due to my lack of material for this interview, I was short of a tape to get the further information that Mr. Mears had talked about. But to let you know that also in this interview, he discussed a study that he was doing on the black graduates of Urbana High School during the last 5 years. And he was trying to find out the percentage of them that went on to college and higher education. Also, later on in the interview, Mr. Mears had pointed out that most of the blacks that have graduated the last 5 years, which he gave a very high percentage of 90%, graduated in the lower 50% of their class. And he also explained the problem that associated with this high percentage, which was the lack of motivation. Also in the interview, Mr. Mears, or Dr. Mears, talked about the parents and their relationship with their child and their education. And he has stated in his final request that he wished to see in the future that more black parents will become more involved as a person in the Urbana School District. Thank you.